Club for Business Impact. Today we're covering lessons learned implementing the Great Demo methodology, covered by the book Great Demo by Peter Cohen. The promise of the Book Club for Business Impact is actionable insights for entrepreneurs and change agents drawn from the panelists' experience and informed by the book's content. We're fortunate today to have two change agents, Barry Nelson of Factor Lab and Julie Robbins, an independent EMR consultant, join us on the panel with Peter and myself. Barry, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Barry Nelson. I'm the CEO of Factor Lab. And at Factor Lab, we focus on helping organizations bridge the gap between good people, good practices, and great execution. So big fan of Peter and his work and looking forward to contributing.
And Jolie.
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon. This is Jolie Rollins. I'm a consultant in the healthcare information technology field, the HIT, and change management leader. I've held management roles at Glowstream, Allscripts, Mises, Medic, and Investors Title. And I'm a graduate of NC State University in accounting. I'm pleased to be here. I am a huge fan of Peter's and have implemented his methodology at multiple companies and organizations. So happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And Sean. Hey, I'm Sean Murphy. I'm the CEO of SK Murphy. We consult on technology market creation and new product introduction. I had long stays at Cisco, 3Com, and AMD. I have a couple of degrees from Stanford, and our focus for our clients is helping them find early customers and early revenue. Been a big fan of the Great Demo for many years. My first experience on going to one of Peter's workshops in about 2004 was to kind of smack myself on the forehead and go, damn, I've been doing it wrong.
And with that delightful introduction, hi, I'm Peter Cohen. I'm the founder of this enormous organization called The Second Derivative, inventor putatively of the Great Demo methodology. You can read the rest of this. I do want to comment on Barry and Jolie, because they represent two very important ends of the spectrum with respect to implementation of frankly, any methodology. We're using Great Demo today as an example. Barry has been the CEO of several companies, and at one level, a CEO is pushing, if you will, outwards and downwards to try to see ideas implemented. And so his observations and experiences there come from that perspective, which is very important. And Jolie has been a middle manager at a series of organizations implementing methodologies and training. And in the case of being a middle manager or upper middle manager, one is often pushing several directions at once and pulling very craftily as well, because you're dealing with people who are your peers, people in other portions of the organizations about whom you may have no control, people above and people below. So I wanted just to give that quick introduction. So with that, let's do a rapid overview of some of the key ideas of the methodology. I do want to remind everybody that this is a roundtable discussion in a virtual sense. So visualize in your heads a round table, even though it may extend across continents. Please use, as it says here, the questions tab in the GoToMeeting, GoToWebinar interface. At any time, if you want to ask a question, Sean is going to moderate these and surface ones that appear to be appropriate as we go along. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, to recap the key ideas of a Great Demo, it's what this slide says right here. And actually, let me ask if Sean, Jolie, and Barry would just read it all together out loud.
Do the last thing first.
And do the last thing first.
Thank you. With typical workshops, do it with less passion. In any case, the idea here is very simple, and that is to invest sufficient time to understand your customer's situation, what it is they're looking for out of your offering, and instead of holding it traditionally to the end of a demonstration, you present that end deliverable right up front, right away, so your audience members can see exactly where this is going and what's in it for them. And if it does resonate, they get interested, and you are then able to begin to, if you will, peel back the layers in accord with your customer's depth and level of interest. As I like to say, this results in crisp, effective demos that get the job done and yield the kinds of results we're typically seeking. It is also fundamentally a different way of doing demos from the way that most people are trained. And that's really what is driving this discussion today. Now, two other quick observations with respect to demos and demo methodology. Number one, there are really two different types of demos. The first are what are known as technical proof. These are demos where you have had a chance to meet with your customer previously or have a conversation. You've done discovery. You've uncovered and communicated between the two of you a clear understanding of their situation and what capabilities they're looking for. In the case of a technical proof demonstration, your job is effectively to do exactly what we just described. It's to very rapidly show them what kind of solution is possible, that end result right up front, and then go as deeply as they have interest in the balance of the demo. That's called technical proof. Second type of demo is called vision generation, and I need to contrast this. This is not where you are simply showing up and throwing up. You still are turning a traditional demo upside down, but in these cases, you often have very little information about your customer's situation. And so one way to think about these kinds of demos is you're trying to present them with a very attractive appetizer, very tasty appetizer, which causes them to get engaged and from which you are hoping they will order a main course, a bunch of sides, and a fabulous dessert, not to mention an elegant wine to complement. In any case, these are the two types of demos. In our workshops and our training, we discriminate between these. The fundament, though, is, as I said, doing things backwards, in a sense, turning a demo upside down. So with that in mind, we'll take one final look here. It's on a tool called a situation slide. This is a tool we use for capturing and communicating information we've learned through our discovery conversations. This tool and the six elements that are listed here, I believe, prove to be fundamentally, let's put it this way. It is the fundament for being able to structure a demonstration that really seeks to address a customer's needs. So with that, let me stop and turn things over to, if you will, the rest of the panel by framing the following question. Folks in the panel, will you let the audience members read this question on their own? And let me start with Jolie, who was implementing this methodology and others at some rather large organizations. So what's a key challenge you had to overcome, and how did you go about doing it?
Thank you, Peter. One of the biggest challenges was my goal in the project was to ingratiate Great Demo as part of the culture. So I really had to be a change agent inside the organization, and that part of the success, I would deem it as successful in both companies, was I used the Great Demo methodology to sell it internally to those up above and outwards in the organization, and by that, I've created a vision for them of what it would look like once we were all on board with the Great Demo methodology. I leveraged the leadership, the executive leadership. I gave them questions to ask when they were dealing with salespeople so that they didn't have to think of those questions, so it's the path of least resistance. I also gave the individual users, the sales reps, the pre-sale support, the engineers, if you will, I gave them permission to pick a few methodology, a few tips to use first, and not absolutely have to change how they're doing things completely. So we would do three great demo techniques, and once we mastered those, then we would move on to three more great demo techniques. So they give them a level of comfort without losing the great demo experience.
So I'm going to ask a follow-up question that is not expected because I just thought of this. Jolie, how did you deal with the people in the organization who offered a phrase something like, gee, is this just the training flavor of the quarter? If you know what I mean by that.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and that was, we fought that pretty hard. We had a lot of folks who felt like this was an event versus this is how we were going to do things, and it took a lot of work before you came on site and did the Great Demo workshops. We rolled it out incrementally at one company where we started with the pre-sales support, and then we focused on the sales reps that we thought would be more adaptable to change. We picked some old dogs, if you will, and we also picked some new hotshot talent and rolled that out to them. And then we were able to start telling the success stories and generate the interest. And that really kept the momentum going. There were very few conversations about wins or losses, which are important to debrief on, where we didn't talk about great demo techniques that were used. It was part of the executive leadership's vocabulary.
So one of the things you're mentioning here is that this kind of implementation, this kind of training cannot be thought of as an event, but really has to be not only perceived as, but delivered as an ongoing process. And that's perhaps a perfect segue to Barry. What was a key challenge you had to overcome, and how did you do it?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. I was listening to Jolie's answer, and I was thinking about myself. I think the biggest challenge I had to get over was myself and my own misaligned expectations. Because the first time that we tried to implement this, I fell in love with Peter Stuff, and I said, he writes this great blog, and he really gets it. And then I just thought we could implement it, and it would just work. And I failed at the very first slide that you put up, which I didn't really think about how are we going to do reinforcement that means the last thing first. And the last thing is reinforcing and creating a habit. So as we learned, we had to learn first up front that it's not going to just happen automatically just because I want it to happen, or I want my people to follow it, or I want my people to agree with Peter. It's not the reason it's going to happen. You have to think through the end and say, after this training is done, how are we going to reinforce it? How are we going to create a habit? How am I going to make this easy for people to do? And that's what we did the second time around, is that we baked in the habit piece of this to the initial training, and that it gives us a much better result.
And again, I'm going to ask you a question that just came up. What specific examples of habit-forming exercises, or in other words, what specific things did you do to really try to make this an ongoing process?
Yeah, I think you take your situation slide as an example. I think that's a great habit that we have to get into the business of thinking about. So if you take everything that Peter says and you say, oh, I can only focus on one thing, and the one habit I'm going to do is I'm going to get, before we do any demo, I'm going to make sure that there's an opportunity for the salesperson and the sales engineer to have a conversation about the situation slide. So if you just focus on that one habit, and what triggers that habit, and how we can make sure that we can give feedback 60 seconds or less on that particular slide, we'll get good at that piece. When you get good at that piece, it supports all the other great things that come out of the training.
Excellent. And thank you. Sean, how about you? What's a key challenge you and working with your cadre of early stage companies were able to overcome?
I think that the challenge of getting to the point in 6 minutes and really figuring out what the key thing to present is forces a lot of conversation and a lot of argument, and sticking with that and trying to determine what the key point to make is for a particular opportunity consumes a lot of time.
So excellent. I want to share also just some information I've collected from some of my other customers. Going back to this idea of the situation side, if you're looking for just one thing to implement, as both Jolie and Barry were talking about, this is a very important starting point. From a customer, I received an email message that said, as a result of, well, they said, quote, this, for those projects that had a complete situation slide for each player, no decisions in their organization ran at less than 10%. For sales projects that had incomplete situation slide information, no decision rates were above 60%. So that's a rather compelling metric to communicate. So I think this is a great example of a simple tool to use to really decide, have we uncovered the information we need before we even start moving our mouse in a demo?
All right. Peter, yeah. We had a question on that.
Uh-huh.
What's the difference between no decision and a loss?
Thank you. So no decision is defined as the customer effectively does nothing. You don't win. You don't lose to a competitor. It's a sales opportunity that appears on a forecast and just continues to appear year after year after year. The customer effectively does nothing. In software, no decision rates range, for those companies that track them, range between about 30 and 70%, typically speaking. it is, for many, many software organizations, the single biggest, and I'm putting quotes around this in the air, competitor that typical sales teams face. So does that answer that question?
Yes.
So I'll comment that by, and I'll repeat this, by simply using a situation slide and answering effectively, have we adequately completed the elements of information that are on this, if you simply reduce your no decision rates, you'll find that your overall success rates are going to go up correspondingly. All right, ladies and gentlemen in the audience, key challenges for startups. So this is a range of questions that we could address. Jolie, do you have some ideas about how to look at some of these?
I do. Thanks, Peter. You know, there was a saying in a startup that I worked at that, you know, this place must have been a heck of a lot of fun to work at before we had the first customer. And the reason there was we knew what our vision was. We had done internal demos to each other. We suffered from what we call expertise-itis, in that we had grown up with the company. We knew all of the features and functions, and we were there when we had literally a five-minute demo because that's all we had. As new features and functions were added, now all of a sudden we've got an hour and a half demo, and I'll just pause for a second and ask the audience, is there anybody in this audience who has an hour and a half to give to a demo, to a presentation? None of us do. Sean is very respectful about cutting this meeting off at, you know, the time that he says he is, because he's respectful of your time. And I would say that, you know, it's the same thing with our customers when back when we were implementing this as well. So once you get into that mode and you start developing new features and functions based on possible prospect feedback, it's difficult for you to put yourself in that customer's mindset, right? You're experts, right? You understand what you're looking at, and you forget that your customer may not understand what they're looking at if you're doing that vision creation demo, more specifically if you're doing the technical proof demo. Then you should be able to relate it to things that they do each and every day. So that was, you know, some of the things there, you know, we had to do is constantly remind ourselves and be vigilant with each other to say, where is the customer right now? What is their mindset? Do they understand? Are we talking above their head? Are we making them feel stupid by using our own words that mean nothing to them and have no relevance whatsoever? So constantly challenging yourself and creating an environment where you can challenge yourself so that you keep yourself on par, equal with your customer, not below or above. From the convincing the engineering, the pre-sales support or sales engineers to tone it down a bit, it's part of what we did there at one company was a lot of practice and a lot of dry runs. I think it's very difficult once you get the spotlight shining on you. It's very easy just to put in that cassette tape. Again, I'm going to date myself here, but putting in the cassette tape and just getting on autopilot. There's nerves, there's pressure, there's, we have to show this because we want to deal one time when we said this and we showed this feature. So it's practice, 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 and it's doing dry runs. And I would say when you're changing things, I would schedule at least 2 dry runs. And then plan for time afterwards to do a debrief where you talk about what worked. You talk about in your pre-demo dry runs, you talk about what questions do you want to get, what questions do you hope you get, who is going to answer them, how are we going to respond, so that you know everybody goes in with a sense of this isn't the first time that we've done it. And then, you know, creating an environment there where you can also call out and say, you're using words that only we understand. Nobody else understands what that means. And then how do you channel entrepreneurial pride and passion to focus on the customer? And I think that's relatively easy, but it does take a little discipline. And that's keeping your eye on the prize, which is the win. It isn't about your ego. It isn't about I spoke eloquently. It's about, in the end, did we get the results that we wanted? Did we get to the next step? Did we win the deal? Whatever the defined win is, ultimately did we get there? And creating that, channeling that passion into winning versus my ego, CEO's ego, EVP's ego.
So this is perfect. And if I take out of this a couple of takeaways, if you will, number one is, or not in order, dry runs. Very, very important to dry run what it is you're going to present so that everybody's clear and everybody's comfortable. Number two, I think I was hearing, is you have to help people let go of, well, let's put it this way. In my experience with traditional demos, over time, I've never seen demos get shorter. With each new release, with each new module that's added, with each new sets of functions, demos only get longer. And so, if you will, demo teams and people that are preparing presenting them have to perform triage. They have to ask the question, what is most important for the customer to take away? What do we want to keep behind our back and ready to show? And what is just not relevant at all? From the Monty Python movie, the Holy Grail, there's a famous phrase, and it has to do with, I believe, the holy hand grenade, and it goes something like, three shall be the number, et cetera, et cetera. The rest of you can all hum along with the rest of it at home. Most humans can only retain about three key pieces of information from any particular engagement. And so if you've got to cut your demo down to three key messages you want them to remember, that's one way to help, I think, address this idea. Barry, how about you? Key challenges for startups.
I'm just going to address the last one, Peter, because it's particularly what you were just saying before. What we're finding, we did it in our own organization that worked, and we're finding another organization that really works, is focus less on what the salesperson is doing and more on what are the behaviors that you want the buyer or the prospect to be doing when you're doing whatever it is that you're doing. And so those behaviors are, Julie was starting to kind of get to them, we used to think of them in terms of outcomes, but there's things that the customer will either say, do, or give in a demo, which will really indicate to us that we're on the right path. So yeah, getting a next meeting is a good idea. The customer maybe describe what his problem is in more, clear terms. We can get him engaged in sort of co-designing either the demo or co-designing, a solution to the problem. So if you can flip it around from worrying about what it is that you're going to do to really kind of driving it from what is the buyer going to be doing during the demo, we're finding that we're more focused on them than us, and we get the result quicker.
This is really fascinating. One of the things that I used to do when I was managing teams, and I still do in workshops where I'm doing ride-alongs, is watch the audience. And through the course of a demo, let's say you have a demo scheduled for an hour, it's fascinating to watch the audience's body language. And when you do a debrief at the end, you can relate to whoever was presenting or doing the demo what transpired. And far too often, audiences start off sitting neutrally, and by about 3 minutes into a traditional demo, they're slumped in their chairs. And about 5 minutes into it, after they've stopped thinking, where the heck is this going, they are doodling, they are covertly swiping away on their iPhones or tapping away on their BlackBerries. They're simply disconnected. And if you plot their attention over time in a traditional demo, it's really frightening to see how, if you will, checked out audiences typically are. So one, I would call it a metric that one could use is, how often has the audience checked out during the course of a demo? Or conversely, how long was the audience paying engaged attention and sitting forward in their chairs when you're in a face-to-face environment? This is a great way to track, if you will, the progress for any particular individual or the structure of a demo. Sean, let me ask you. Sorry, who's this?
That was Barry. Can I add one thing to what you were just saying, which is a great exercise people can do, and I think it builds on what Sean was saying before. If you just think about your demo and just think through 3 to 5 behaviors that you really want your buyer to be doing, so like you're saying, and then think about how you're going to measure those and use that as the metric of could we get, and by the way, it helps lots of things like forecasting and other stuff too, but can we get the buyer to do X? Can we get the buyer to engage? Can we get the buyer to tell us this? And think through, how is the demo going to support you getting to those outcomes? The dialogue, number one, is critical. the focus, getting down to three or five things, is really going to be very helpful. And then the third piece of that is you're going to reshape how you do your demo, because it's going to be focused on those things.
Excellent. So people can effectively make that list of attributes that you want them to watch for.
Correct.
Sean, how about you?
So I actually think it's much harder before you have customers for a couple of reasons. One is some of your early customers may be old coworkers or old bosses or people that very much give you the benefit of the doubt. And so although you may have given them a demo, they're reaching a conclusion based on other information. So the process of actually tuning the demo when you're getting kind of negative results time after time, you have to resist the sales adage that every no leads to a yes, because if you keep doing the same thing, you don't improve. So the tuning process is hard. I got called in a while ago to a team that had recruited a VP of sales from a billion-dollar software company, and they had gone in and done 30 demos, and I sat there, and they gave me a demo that ran about, I don't know, 90 minutes. And it was quite extensive. And I said, okay, so show me the first version of the demo. What's the first version you gave? Show me what you've learned in giving these 30 demos. Because this guy could open doors to a number of companies. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, how have you changed the demo in response to your prospects' feedback? And he goes, this is exactly what I'm talking about. We need to find smarter prospects. And I think there's a temptation sometimes to, if they don't get it, you just take that same message, which you know is good, and keep giving it until you find somebody. I think you've got to resist that temptation.
You know, going back for a second to the situation slide, you can use this in two guises, two modes. The first is what we know about our customer's situation. And we start off, what we recommend in a great demo methodology is to actually start off and review your understanding of the customer's situation before you start showing anything in your software, for the semi-obvious reason of making sure that you are in alignment with your customer. That is a delightful starting point for a technical proof demo. A vision generation demo, which Sean, your customer here who had done the 30 demos and hadn't yet gotten any orders, vision generation, you can use this same construct. You simply flip it around. So instead of starting off by saying, "Dear Mr. Customer, when we met 2 weeks ago, if I understand correctly, you shared the following information with me about your critical business issue, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera," you start off by saying, "Dear Mr. Customer, we've never met before, but let me show you how we've helped or we expect to help other customers with a similar job title, a similar industry, in situations that let me describe here as follows." That sets things up because it helps do two things. Number one, three things. Number one, it gets you out of a traditional demo mode of let me just show you our stuff. Number two, it invites the customer to actually think for a moment about how does this compare. In other words, they immediately have to become engaged, and that's what you want. And number three, and perhaps most important, if what you just articulated resonates with a customer, they may say, yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing I'm interested in doing. Now show me what you're going to do to help us solve this problem. And then you are, as they say, off and running. So,
Peter, we
yes,
had a question on that.
Uh-huh.
What are essentially the questioners having trouble understanding how to probe for critical business issue and capabilities thought? Are there some examples of ways that you do that?
Oh, absolutely, and that's a topic for another entire workshop. So, no, I will. It is, but we'll trim this down. So. Most people, let me grab a pen here. When you ask most people what kind of problems or what kinds of issues you're facing, they answer it, if you will, at this level. They'll say something like, let's use sales forecast system as an example. Somebody says, I need a new sales forecast system. And if you're selling these things, you'd say, oh, terrific, traditionally. You'd say, we've got a bunch of those. Let's talk about what you have in mind. And what happens there is you talk back and forth between these two levels, if you will, of the process. You're talking about what they're doing today and how they're doing it and what kinds of capabilities they're looking for, what kinds of capabilities are in your offering. What you haven't asked, and Jolie or Barry, I'm going to ask you to articulate it, is one critical question, which is? Sound of crickets in an empty room.
Why are you doing this?
Thank you. Okay, or Sean. Yeah, the answer to the question, where's my mouth? The answer to the question, why do you want a new system, is what really drives the entire process. And it's often the question that is, let's say, forgotten or simply not asked in the process of doing discovery. So I hope that gives a partial answer to the person that asked that question. But that's probably the single most important question to ask, or set of questions. They're known as why questions. Why is it important? What's driving this? Why do you need it now? And so forth. Does that help?
Yeah, I think that's good.
Okay. I think it's time to change gears. Questions for panel. With respect to individuals, there's three sets of questions here. What habits are hardest to get rid of? Well, you guys can read these on your own. So this one here. And then, of course, this one here. And I simply want to offer that I believe this word right here is a critical word, and that's something we can talk about in a few minutes. Barry, would you like to start this discussion?
Sure. I'll just tackle a couple of these, and then we have some dialogue around it. I can jump back in later. I think the most difficult habits to get rid of are ones where we don't have a soon and certain benefit associated with it. For example, weight loss or smoking cigarettes are good examples. You know, trying to stop them, it takes a while before, and the benefit is a little bit uncertain before we're going to see the reward. So I think in relative to the demo world, we need to think of the same thing, which is if I'm going to get in the habit of to use a situation slot as an example, I need to find a way that I can get into the habit of doing this and I get a soon and certain reward for that. And that reward could be reinforcement from my boss, or that reward could be reinforcement from my peers. But if you don't have a way to reinforce the use of this habit in the short term, you're waiting on the distant and uncertain outcome, which is, hey, I'm going to sell something, you know, maybe 6 months later. It makes it very, very hard for people to get into the habit of making change. And so that's that's my summary to the first two. And what types of peer-to-peer review or coaching are most useful? It's ones that are quick and to the point and focused. So we find that the success of Twitter and Facebook, as an example, are not by accident. And what those are really all about is people being able to very, very quickly both see and respond to other people. And the more that you can get into the habit of coaching in 60 seconds or less, and particularly by your peers, the more success you're going to see with changing habits like the ones we're talking about here today.
So one of the, and I think you've alluded to this, one of the strongest drivers of change appears to be seeing success with one's peers. Some people refer to this as a virtuous circle, a virtuous cycle. Any comments about that from any of the three of you? And you can just jump in.
Go ahead, Julie. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say it absolutely is important, and we labored over who was in the circle versus who was out when we were implementing great demo methodology at the first company that we rolled this out. And in case you're wondering, that's how good this is it's a game changer for me. When I go to a new company, they have to take great demo with me. It's a part of who I am now. But I would say, you know, we were very picky and choosy about which sales reps and pre-sales support staff we rolled this out to first. We wanted people who were going to be respected. We wanted people who were skeptical. We wanted people who were perceived as leaders and winners, and people who other people wanted to be like and emulate. That was on purpose, because we knew in order to keep the momentum that if we could get this core group, then they would mentor their peers. They wouldn't get behind our backs and say, yeah, it's actually a bunch of BS. We're not really doing it. We're just giving them lip service. We're doing it the same old way. So we wanted to make sure that they were supportive, and we made it an elite group. And that was one way that we could, you know, enlist them to be coaches, to get them as excited. So it was finding the right mix of skepticism as well as someone who would be truthful and say, yeah, I'm not really going to do this, but I will do this. And in setting them up, you start those stories, those informal or formal reference stories internally. It's using the Great Demo methodology and turning it inwards to be a change agent in your own company.
And so what kinds of activities did you actually do to both, let's say, reinforce the virtuous circle and pump it, if you will? Are there things you did as within the team, or what did you do?
Yeah, so we certainly highlighted that. When we would have company meetings, when executives would reach out to sales reps, to congratulate them, when we would tell the story of the win so that everybody could emulate it, Great Demo was always a part of that. In fact, it was generally observed as the reason why they didn't waste X amount of time. And I think that's important, is that, you know, it focuses your sales team, and that's really what we were lacking. No Decision was probably 70% of who we lost to back in the day, and that was because we didn't have a focus. From the peer-to-peer, it was setting up peers. So someone would say, Jolie, I just tried this, and it was awesome. They were wiggling in their seats. They were leaning forward. You know, it was all of the body language that you look for. And you say, you know, can you give, you know, X a call? They're struggling a little bit with believing that this can really happen. Can you share your excitement and your passion? And again, that's how you take that entrepreneurial passion and you drive it towards the goals that you want. In this case, the adoption of Great Demo.
So, curiosity question, did you causatively generate and use mentors of the methodology?
We did. It was important. And we did not call them mentors. We were hesitant to call them coaches as well, but it was. We certainly drove them to that behavior. So it was on purpose, but not formally expressed.
You know, in my experiences with methodology training, and this is both with Great Demo and pre-Great Demo when I was managing field organizations, what I found is that any particular group of people that went through any kind of methodology training seemed to break into three subgroups. The first group were those that I would say that they got it. They got the ideas, and they were comfortable and confident to go out and apply them right away in day-to-day practice. Unfortunately, this is a gross minority of people, most typically, probably less than 10% or 20% of any particular group. The majority group are those that go through a training program. They understand the ideas, but they're on the fence. And from their perspective, they don't want to try something new because of risk, because of whatever. And they're really looking for success with some of their peers. And so I could see how the processes of using mentors, coaches, or whatsoever you want to call them, and hearing how success stories have helped others achieve the kinds of gains they're looking for, they will help push those people, if you will, over the fence. The third group, well, we'll get to those in a little bit. We can talk about those. Barry, how about you? Comments on habits that are hardest to get rid of, habits that are hardest to develop, and so forth.
Well, I will just kind of build on this conversation you were having about the peer-to-peer thing. I think, you know, the game has really changed. You know, when we first implemented this stuff, Peter, from you, it was, I don't know, almost 10 years ago. Today, it's much easier for people to see through technology little snippets of these of people trying stuff and succeeding in trying stuff and failing, if you will, kind of almost like tweets. But the mobile technology has allowed for that to happen. And I, you know, what we're seeing that really works is, first of all, creating an opportunity where it's going to be okay for people to fail and actually celebrating failure. That it's not only do I expect you not to get the demo thing right the first time, I'm going to tell you that up front, and we're going to bake into the training how we're going to see you fail and how we're going to behave as your peers, not as your mentor or your coaches or whatever, but as your peers, how we're going to behave when we see you struggle and apply and try and reinforce these new habit changes. And if you set that culture up, you begin, you know, start with that intent of the culture, right, and bake in the reinforcement, you can get an entirely different sort of engagement from people because the expectations are different. And it's really, again, I talk about my own personal experience. I had to get out of my own way and create that environment where it was okay to fail and reward and recognize people for helping and coaching and trying. And that's what a lot of people, I think, it's probably the biggest mistake people make is they try and either pretend that question doesn't exist or they try and leave it all up to the sales manager to try and be that coach, and it just doesn't work because salespeople want to learn, frankly, from the guy that's the smartest sales guy and the one who's making the most money. They don't want to hear from a consultant. They don't really want to learn from their boss. They want to learn from their peers, and they want to learn from the ones they know can make money.
That is it. It's all about the results there. It's all about emulating the right behavior. I completely agree with you on that, Barry. And that's, you know, they don't care what anybody else has to say. It's the same thing with our customers. They want, you know, they want results and they want them quick. And I think it's the same thing.
In my experience, there are at least two activities that have resulted in some of the most progress, let's say. The first is regular team meetings. When you have a group of people that have gone through a training, this is part of the reinforcement that both Jolie and Barry have been talking about, and Sean. Regular team meetings where a portion of that call is discussing, typically done, let's say, over a conference call, a portion of that call is discussing, so who here has tried out the new methods or who has been applying them on an ongoing basis, what's been working, what's not working, where have you had successes and where have you had challenges. By constantly keeping this, if you will, in front of the team, you ratchet up their performance. And what you'll find is the people that are having success will trumpet those successes in those meetings, those virtual meetings, which then causes the people who have been, if you will, on the fence to climb over to the grass is greener side where they're actually applying some of the ideas. And then for the benefit of, if you will, everyone, they're able to tune up their performance based on shared experiences and, if you will, shared solutions to the kinds of challenges they might face. So item number one is regular team calls after any kind of a training, let's say training event has taken place, so it really becomes a process. Number two, as alluded to by Jolie, the first time you get a salesperson for Great Demo saying, wow, sending an email message to the pre-sales person saying, wow, that was a great demo. The customer loved it, and we're going to get the order. They said that was the best demo they've ever seen. Those kinds of messages need to be picked up, and I'll ask the group here, what needs to happen to them?
You've got to shout it from the rooftops immediately.
There you go. And Jolie did this literally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from the CEO all the way through to the janitorial staff, I believe, if I recall correctly.
I did that sometimes too, yeah.
Sean, thoughts on this slide? Sean, if you're still
muted,
with us.
We've got a couple questions come in. Sorry, I've been muted to kind of type them. I think the hardest thing is to make sure you're giving the right message to the person you're talking to. There's a tendency you have maybe favorite features or favorite things that have worked, and you've always got to do some sort of diagnosis or discovery to make sure you're focusing your message on the person you're talking to. And I think that we tend to slip back into training mode or, you know, my favorite feature mode, I think.
So this is huge. This is a basis of the fundament, the methodology itself. I'll tell you a brief amusing story. Way back when I was working at a company that did software for the pharmaceutical and chemical industry, we came up with a new function that we called internally the Way Cool tool. And it was freaking way cool. It drew structures with a single mouse down, chemical structures that is, for those who are interested. Single mouse click down, you effectively could build tetramethyl chicken wire. It was fabulous. And guess what the customers thought about it? Anybody?
Crickets.
Exactly. Their perspective was, we generally take an existing structure and just edit it. So your Way Cool tool, just fine, but yeah, we don't really even plan to use it. So this idea of understanding what the customer's situation is and mapping to their needs, but with a bias towards what you do well in discovery, is one of the fundamental tenets of this methodology. Sean, anything else? Any other questions?
So I think the other thing is especially when you're making that transition from giving a lot of demos where it doesn't work to finally somebody says, this is great, how do we get started? If you haven't actually thought through to that point, you can then undo the sales opportunity right there. I was in a situation where we had talked to a lot of people and we hadn't quite had a click, and finally somebody said, hey, let's get started. How do we get started? We were looking at each other going, well, no one's ever said that before.
What do we do? What do we do? They want our product.
No, so I think practicing all the way out to what it's going to take to get it into the customer's hands, I think you can just get into the habit of losing.
Mm-hmm.
The habit of hearing no and expecting it. Yep.
Yeah. Hearing it right. And I
like to offer a favorite phrase of mine is, we are victims of momentum. We tend to do the same things the same way until somebody gives us a firm shove and a reason to do something different. This is the doctor, it hurts when I do this.
Don't do that.
Don't do that. All right. Let us progress. Questions for the panel. Key challenges for large firms. There's four items on this. And I had mentioned that there are three groups of people that typically come out of any methodology training. The third group that I would share with you later is the one with the first bullet here. I've been doing this for years. You can't tell me how to do these things differently. And the other four that are, rather the other three that are here, common suggestions on how to deal with these kinds of situations or similar. So why don't we start again with Jolie?
Yeah, I keep coming back to a constant theme, which is the path of least resistance. So you have to set up a couple of things internally before you go live. You know, I'm using the jazz hands here, but before you go live with Great Demo, in order to make it easier for your pre-sales staff, one, to say no if they don't get all of the discovery or the situation slide that they need, but also to make it easier to choose the right path, to go the way that we want you to go. And that includes having, you know, pre-made situation slides, thinking about what the top 10, top 5 CBIs are that you've solved, how you've done it, getting all of your reference stories together. So there's a lot of work to do before you quote-unquote go live with this and expect it to be part of your culture. And it's creating roadblocks where you want the behaviors to stop, and it's creating that open flow, that path of least resistance where you want to encourage the behavior. And you'll be surprised, and I'm a salesperson, so I'm fairly simple. If you ask me, if my manager or my resources ask me the same question three times, I'm smart enough to come prepared on the fourth time with the answer, so that I would anticipate that need. And good salespeople are wired that way, to anticipate questions and answers. And so you have to set your pre-sales staff up with the permission to say no, to requests that are, you know, that don't satisfy the needs that we have and I use the situation slide because it is the best example, the best tool to use out of the gate. So if you don't have that situation slide, it's giving them permission to push back and say, I don't think that we're ready for a demo yet. So you're not saying no, which pre-sales support staff they're wired to say yes. They're about supporting and helping and being there and being the hero and being available. And now all of a sudden you're telling them that they have to say no. So you have to give them the right phrases. I don't think we're ready yet. Can we get a meeting to talk about this? I'd like to engage Jolie or my senior manager that reported to me, whomever, so that we could get together, get all the questions asked and vetted out. So it's creating those roadblocks and then where you don't want behaviors, where you want to stop behaviors, and then creating the path of least resistance where you want to encourage those behaviors. And I'll tell you straight up on that first one, you know, I've been doing this for decades. You can't tell me how to do this. You know, the only success that I found here is to not confront that person and not expect that person to not get it. As you've heard, Barry and I pretty much gravitated towards Great Demo immediately. We got it. It was like, oh, the light was on for us. And that was a good feeling. We also were cognizant that our peers around us maybe didn't have that same sort of feeling and get it immediately. So my best recommendation for that type of person is you pick on them last. You using the path of least resistance, you take the people who are most willing and able and will generate some results by using Great Demo techniques, and you move them first. We used to call that cherry picking, and this is a lemon drop. You wait until the rest of the organization is there, and then they don't have a choice but to get there.
Peter, I think that's good advice for selling large firms, whether it's your product or anything else, that people are going to sort out in terms of their receptivity. Plan for a phased approach.
Mm-hmm. And I want to highlight something that Jolie said is almost a toss-off, but I think is critical and is interestingly almost unique to what I've seen Jolie do. There's a book called Switch by the brothers Chip and Dan Heath, which is really an examination of how people change and how to help them change. It's a terrific book. One of the things they talk about is to make the pathway smooth and easy for that change to take place. What Jolie did at one of her previous companies, or several for that matter, to make that pathway smooth and easy to follow is that in workshops themselves, we allocated time to actually build some of the tools that people would use. And we used the team itself. Jolie drove this. The team actually did the ideation and generated the materials right there in the last 30 or 45 minutes of the workshop. So instead of leaving this for people to do on their own as they had to start trying to apply these ideas and build up a methodology, they actually had a menu of situation slides and accompanying illustrations. I think we went through and produced 8, 10, or a dozen of these at each workshop so that the team was able to go out saying, oh, okay, I can start using these things right away. And that, I think, was a bit of a game changer because, as I said, it smoothed the path and made it easy to implement. Anyone else care to comment about any of these?
Yeah, Peter, I have a couple quick things. So one, that I think that I'm going to come back to that, what you just said, I think it's absolutely essential. The first two bullets here, I think it goes back to also to your why question. So why is someone saying this? And I would say they're saying that because they don't understand why we're doing this training in the first place. So I think one of the things we've done that helps with this kind of thing is flip the question a little bit and not ask about, it's not about me teaching you anything. Clearly, you know, no one likes that feeling, right? But it's really about asking them the question of what are the buyer behaviors? What's the customer, you know, doing, saying, or giving during a demo, which are our greatest indicators of success? And how often, what's the outcome when we do them? If we're successful in getting them, what is the outcome? Do we get the result that we want? And then we can talk about, depending on who they are, you can begin to get them involved in what you were just describing. You do, and Jolie does, I think, very well, is transfer of ownership. Which you have to transfer the ownership of solving this problem to them. Let them tell you what those behaviors are, and let them have a role in helping do what they do to be successful and helping discover for themselves whether or not they have a real need and whether you can help them. If you don't, you're going to have a hard time actually getting people to buy in.
This leads to a delightful topic, what are referred to often as the four stages of knowledge, I guess. And the first is people who are unconsciously incompetent. In other words, they just don't know that they're not doing things well or they're doing them wrong. The second stage is they've learned what they're doing wrong and they're conscious about it. It's called consciously incompetent. The third stage is that's consciously incompetent, where they know they're doing something wrong. Consciously competent is where they are causatively making changes and they're aware of them and working on them. And then finally, people who are, if you will, naturals, or finally integrated the changes into their day-to-day practice that it's now done literally unconsciously, they're referred to as unconsciously competent. The first group is an interesting one. Very often, people come in skeptical to any type of methodology training. And one of the biggest challenges is to open them up and get them to the point where they're willing to entertain the idea of some new ideas and change. One of the ways I do this in, if you will, my marketing is through my articles, where what I'm trying to do is move people from, if you will, top dead center to a position where they are now uncomfortable. They may not know what a solution is, but they're uncomfortable. Recent article I just released called Stunningly Awful Web Overview Demos, The Gruesome Anatomy of a One-Hour Web Overview, was designed to, in fact, wake people up to exactly that what they're doing today may be non-optimal, trying to move them from unconsciously incompetent to consciously incompetent. Any observations or comments about that?
The only thing I'll add to that is when you talk about the dissection and the triage that you have to do on your presentations, I come from an industry where overviews and presentations could take anywhere from 60 to 90 minutes. And one of the challenges that we put out there at my last company was because the product really was so simple and easy to use, and we wanted to highlight that and make that part of the shtick of the demo, was instead of setting up 60-minute presentations, we set up 5-minute presentations. And that became part of the marketing, part of the drive, was to say, you know, other guys are going to take 60 minutes of your time. We only need 60, you know, we only need, you know, 5 minutes. That, have you got 5 minutes? Good, because we can show you how we can change what you're doing, you know, easily, right? They can talk about ease of use, but if it takes you 60 minutes to get to the point, that's not proving easy, is it? 5 minutes does. So we made the timing of the presentation part of the great demo methodology as well.
So with that, and given where we are with time, let me take us to this slide on Jolie, Barry, Sean, final takeaway ideas.
I do have three lightning questions, too, that have come up.
Okay.
I'm going to work them in, but go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. Jolie, why don't we start with you?
I would just say, you know, prepare your organization, make sure that you've got all levels of the organization covered, executive leadership, as well as those will be individually contributing to the success. Get the buy-in.
Perfect. And Barry?
Bake reinforcement into training. By the way, repetition is the key to unconscious competence. Right?
Don't learn by repetition.
Exactly. We do. Find ways to provide that repetition in 60 seconds or less. So focus, and create an environment where people can go through those cycles in 60 seconds or less, and as often as you possibly can.
Perfect. Sean?
If you can't move them in 6 minutes, another hour won't help. If your first two or three key features or key illustrations don't work, another 10 won't change the equation.
Yes, that is well spoken. And I would offer something that I think the military uses. It's called BLUF, B-L-U-F, and it simply means bottom line up front. They had a big push to get people to get to the point right away, and that's what this is all about. So with that, let's turn things back to Sean for questions from the audience.
Okay. So first question was, we see many startups doing short 60 to 90 second animation to explain their product, for example, Dropbox. Any thoughts on how to use the great demo method for this?
So yes, and by the way, I encourage folks to do shorter rather than longer overviews of their products. Very simply, what I recommend is following that vision generation demo architecture. So you set up the putative use case or use scenario. Here's the kind of situations, dear audience, that we think you might be interested in. And if you are and it resonates, let us show you exactly what the payoff looks like. And if you're interested in that, click here, and we'd be happy to have somebody contact you to learn more about your situation. So I think the approach applies very, very readily. I will comment that you cannot have a one-size-fits-all video. And so if you have different constituencies, you probably need to plan on separate videos for each of those constituencies and or each of their, let's say, top-level challenge areas. Jolie, Barry, anything to add on that?
No, I agree.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's the use case. What are you solving?
Yep, there you go. Hope that answers that question. Sean?
Yeah, one final question. How do you use the situation slide when you're at a trade show and most of the demos are blind dates?
So this is a topic for another whole book club. I recommend using something called a menu, which is effectively a way of listing out 5, 6, 7 high probability scenarios that the customer might have interest in. You can then verbalize those very, very rapidly, almost the form of a situation slide, but you only have, if you will, the topic areas written up on a PowerPoint slide, or even better, we used to and still do laminate these things and put them, Velcro them to the side of a demo station. So when somebody comes up to you with that classic painful question of, "Hi, what do you guys do?" or "Hi, show me a demo," you could point to this poster that says, "Well, we've got there's a list of things we do. Let me just describe each of these verbally and see which of these might be of interest to you." That's a terrific approach for situations where your audience is partly or largely undiscovered. Hope that answers that, at least for now.
Yep, I think that's good.
All right, Sean, we'll turn this back over to you then.
Okay. I want to thank the panel and Peter for taking part. This has been the audience. This has been the Book Club for Business Impact. More information on that is available at the URL on your screen. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.